I'm returning homework one, number one. Next week, Wednesday, we have an exam. So I have asked for a room as soon as I find the available room. It's going to be during class time, an hour and 15 minute exam. So we are looking for a suitable room. As soon as I know that, I'll announce it, probably on Monday. And please take a look at the old exams in preparation. Today we're going to talk about the electrics. Somebody pointed out to me that the clock over there is running late, so I told you guys a little bit extra last time. Apologies about that. Okay. Basically, let's address the following problem. Let's say we have a pair of charge plates, like a capacitor plates. Let's say this is positively charged, this is negatively charged, so we have an electric field pointing from the bottom towards the top, and let's say the vertical direction is the z-direction, that I'm setting up my coordinate system. I have a z-directed electric field produced by the charge distribution, or surface charge distribution in the usual way, and initially we are in vacuum. Now I take one hydrogen atom, or any atom, and place it somewhere in this field. What happens? What happens is that the plus and minuses that constitute that atom get stretched out. The atom gets distorted, and the minuses get attracted to the bottom side, pluses get attracted to the top side. You form a dipole. Okay, I'm exaggerating. Maybe the better picture would be a dipole with a very little separation between the proton and the neutron clouds. And of course, dipole is a dipole. You know how to calculate the field of a dipole, right? Because you can construct the model for the dipole as a superposition of two shifted Coulomb fields. And when you do that, you get the dipole field. Coulomb field goes as 1 over r squared. And the dipole field, maybe you remember from your physics courses, it goes down as 1 over r. You don't remember? 1 over r cubed. Anyway, it's a more complicated field structure, obviously. It sort of looks like this, right? I mean, you have the electric field pointing from the plus to minus, but then it has to do everywhere. So it generates this type of a field structure. You've seen pictures like this, and this has a at large distances compared to the dipole separation, 1 over r cubed type of a field. Okay, so basically, to summarize, when I place my neutral atom in this region where there is an electric field, atom gets polarized, it gets pulled into a dipole, and the field changes because now you have to superpose the field of the dipole. Okay, so that is a distortion. So then what happens if I take a lot of several atoms and places around here? The situation is a little bit more complicated. Now I have several dipoles. Each of them have dipole fields, and I have to add up all those vector fields coming from each dipole plus the original field. That's the picture, okay? Now, of course, the stretching of each atom depends on the fields that the other dipoles have also generated. The problem got a little bit complicated, okay? And I have to take into account all the sources of charges and then somehow model how those impact the atoms in their stretching and so forth. Now, I can make this problem easier by adding even more number of atoms here. What I'm really interested in coming up for a model for is a dielectric material. In a dielectric solid, there are lots of atoms put together. So amazing that the problem will simplify if I will increase the number of atoms here, but at the same time achieve some sort of a symmetry, a symmetric situation where I'll take advantage of symmetries and be able to solve this problem in ways that sounds much easier than what I have so far outlined. Okay, so here's the gist of my idealization. I will assume an infinite sort of a scenario. Everything is uniform and infinite in this direction and into the blackboards. Okay, infinite slab of material is what I'm thinking about. And the plates are infinite, and I have a z-directed electric field, and I want to look at the influence of the new dielectric material that I'm placing there. The other simplification is going to be that my atoms are ordered in an ordered fashion, and in crystals that's just the way things are. And one more thing. So far, when I first started talking about these fields, I was really talking about microscopic fields. I was thinking about the fields coming from the place plus the dipole field of a single atom. That's a microscopic field. But now I should give up my desires to have a microscopic field. I should rather go to a macroscopic field. That is part of the simplification as well. And what is the difference between microscopic fields and macroscopic fields? In calculating macroscopic fields, we sort of like average the microscopic field over scales that are large compared to the particle separations. Okay, so it's sort of a convolved picture that we talked about. First time we introduced this distinction. And when was that? That was when we were solving the problem of having distinct charges delta z apart. And then we first calculated that, but that was a summation. We turned it into an integral and associated the integral answer with the macroscopic counterpart of the original problem. So those are the things that I'm going to do. Okay? And then I can take advantage of the picture I have in my notes. So I'm going to now to my notes. Conductors, we talked about. Now the electric materials is what we're going to talk about. And the real picture that I want to go to is this one. Okay? So basically, in between these two plates, where the dielectric material is, I am choosing now to model my dielectric material as sort of an array of polarized atoms which are constituting dipoles. Here is one, here's another one, here's another one, okay? So these are the locations of original atoms. The next layer of atoms are here, the next layer there, etc. But each layer of atoms have been stretched out, and they are forming, therefore, these double layers. I effectively have plus charges here on one surface and minus charges in one surface. The microscopic field calls me to get the field of this and add all of them together. But that's where I'm lazy. I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to say, because of the symmetry that we see there, the organization see there, why don't we treat all of these atoms in this layer in one go? Okay, what am I going to do? Well, I have a surface charge here. That is, all the pluses are constituting a surface charge layer there. And then I have another surface charge here that is constituted by all the displaced electrons. And I know how to calculate the fields in between double surface layers and outside. What are the fields outside? Go to last week. What is it? If I have equal and opposite rho sub s is on two surfaces, the fields outside are?
Zero.
And what's the field inside? There is a doubling effect. It is rho sub s divided by epsilon naught with the appropriate direction, pointing from plus charges to the minus charges. So I say, okay, so now my dielectric is a whole bunch of double layers sitting on top of one another. Within the double layers, there is going to be electric fields, which are going to be rho sub s divided by epsilon naught. And this rho sub s depends how many atoms there are arranged in this. We're going to look at that momentarily. So basically, I have a rho sub s divided by epsilon naught and a minus z hat because that electric field is pointing downwards. And I am sticking with this picture here. Originally, there is a field that sort of like stretches out the atoms. And now the atoms in that dielectric material has been portrayed here. We are going to calculate the fields that are generated because of the stretched atoms in the way that I am setting up. Once we have that field, we will superpose on top of that field the original field that we have started with, because after all, the total field is due to all the charges. Okay, I have to add whatever fields are generated by all the charges in the scenario to be able to say this is my total field. We're going to do that at the level of macroscopic fields. All right, so that I'm now halfway through my derivation. So then we have a field here, and then zero field here. We have, again, the same field here, zero field here. So I have a model of this dielectric as a sandwich. Many layers, okay, some layers have zero electric field, other layers have this electric field that is proportional to the charge density. So now let's look at the charge density. What is the charge density? Okay, I have to set some dimensions here. I'm going to assume that my atoms are separated from their neighboring atoms by delta x, delta y, and delta z dimensions. Delta z is in the vertical. Okay, so you can see delta z here. This is delta z. Well, this separation is delta x, and there is a similar delta y into the blackboard, okay? So the surface is really then provided for you by delta x, delta y combo, okay? Each charge, E, is sitting at the corner of a delta x, delta y square, okay? Or a rectangle of dimensions delta x, delta y, okay? And then what is the charge density? You guys tell me. E divided by delta x, delta y, okay? Every time I see a delta x, delta y surface, I can see adjacent to it associated charge E. So since every E has that, my total charge density on that surface, E divided by delta y, delta x. Now, also, there is a cube, delta x, delta y, delta z, a volume, an elemental volume associated with that an atom, okay? So 1 over that volume is going to be my number density of the atoms that are in my entire picture. Okay? So that is going to come into picture as well. So E divided by delta x delta y is my charge density, and then volume per atom is delta x delta y delta z, and its inverse is the number density. It is per meter cube. So many atoms per meter cube. So I have sort of set up myself here. And there they are. Answer D and Rosales. Okay, so now, coming back to my picture, I have two regimes or two different electric fields. E sub 1 refers to the electric fields that I have between the double layers, within a double layer, let us say. E sub 2 is the zero field that is occupying the region between the double layers. Okay? And now, so far I have a quasi-microscopic electric field. It is microscopic in the sense that it is recognizing the transition, an idealized transition from E1 to E2, then again from E2 to E1, and that is there is a microscopic sort of a structure in the z direction, but at the same time it is a bit macroscopic. In one sense, in what sense is it macroscopic? Why don't you say? I have fudged a little bit. Whatever I have done my fudging, that is the cause of a little bit of a macroscopic approach there. Where have I fudged? Yeah, we have smeared out. Yeah, we have polarized those distinct charges over that surface. That smearing is responsible for the macroscopic. Thank you. All right, so in the end, I am going to be averaging everything over all dimensions, even including Z, therefore I will have a macroscopic field, all right? So let's just do that then. So I say that my macroscopic electric field, which is somehow a combination of E1 and E2 with the right weights, okay? And I say the reasonable thing to do is to look at the full dimension here, which is delta Z, and recognize that out of delta z, the region that is occupied by the electric field that is non-zero is of some dimension d, okay? And that d is the plus minus separation in each of those double layers. In each atom, the pluses and minuses separate by some distance, and I'm calling d. That d then becomes the metric for evaluating E1 as compared to delta z, and zero is, of course, likewise weighted by the complement. But weighting zero by anything doesn't much mean much. Okay? So there we go. So I'm going to now take my E1, which is that formula here, and take my E2, which is zero there, multiply them in succession by d over delta z, and the complement divided by delta z. This doesn't contribute because E2 is equal to zero, and it gives me my macroscopic electric field. Okay? So I get my minus z hat that is coming from there. E over epsilon naught gets multiplied by d, that is the dipole separation between the two charges. And then what else do I have? I have delta x, delta y coming from there, but there is a delta z that is coming from here. So I have a triple product here. Now, 1 over delta x, delta y, delta z is what? That is the number density. So then I erase this and put the number density. Okay, and here I have epsilon naught I bring downstairs. And on the top I see, apart from the unit vector, n, which is the number density of atoms, charge of a single proton, and d is the distance between the proton and the electron. Okay, so basically I have said, hey, that is my polarization. I'm going to give this guy a name. I'm going to give this vector a name. I'm going to call it capital P. That will become an important field that will somehow combine with the electric field and give us our revised definition of the displacement. That's where we are going. Okay. Another way of looking at this is to say capital P is the field that is the number density times the small p. Small p is the dipole moment associated with a single dipole. That is simply the distance between a separated plus and minus times the charge itself. That is P. Okay? So that P is the individual dipole, and then when you multiply that individual dipole with the number density of the dipoles, you get the polarization. That's our picture. Any questions? So these are a bunch of definitions after going through a process. In that process, we are going from microscopic field into a macroscopic field. Any questions? So P is a macroscopic, sort of electric field. It's not quite electric field because electric field is P divided by epsilon naught. P has the units of not an electric field, but displacement, because that's what's going to happen. Any questions? So now, I'm almost at the end. This is the field, my stretched out and distorted and excited. The right word is polarized. The electric is posing. Okay? But there is also electric field that is due to other charges in the region. They are not included here. I have to add those, and then I have my total electric field. And that is my model. The total electric field is E sub 0, which is produced by these guys, plus the electric field that I have, which is negative P divided by epsilon naught. You see that the dipoles polarize in such a way that the field that has been generated by these double layers is pointing opposite to what was exciting the full thing. That is why you have a minus sign over there. Okay. Now, if instead of a dipole, the electric material, we had stuck here a conductor, there would have been a more drastic change. Within the conductor, we would achieve zero electric field because the free charge carriers that are available in conductors would have migrated to the surfaces to generate an internal field that would have exactly eliminated E sub zero. That is what we've seen yesterday. But in the electric material, you don't have such free charges. There are no charges to go and accumulate on the surfaces. Instead, you're just stretching out the neutral elements that are constituting this material. And whether or not it will be canceling out depends on the inner workings of that atom. There must be some thing that holds that atom stronger or weaker. That has to be modeled, that we haven't modeled yet. And the picture here is a little bit more complicated in that sense. And our model for the electric material will continue over the next several lectures at few steps. So this is the picture that we have. Now, I will rewrite this equation in such a way that we will now soon achieve what I will call a revised definition of displacement. What do? I multiply both sides of that equation on the top by epsilon naught, so that I have on the right hand side epsilon naught times E minus P, and then on the left hand side I have epsilon naught times E, and epsilon naught times E naught on the other side. Okay, so then I take the following operation. I take the divergence of both sides. When I take divergence of both sides, I have divergence of epsilon naught times E naught. I say divergence of epsilon naught times E naught is related to the charge density that is associated with the free charges that are generating the electric field. So when I started my derivation, I have some free charges here. Whereas the charges which are in my double layers are bound charges. So I am making a distinction between free charges and bound charges, okay? So in the earlier picture, we had the following relationship. Divergence of E is equal to rho divided by epsilon naught. And this microscopic picture that we started with at the beginning of the semester counted all the charges, okay? But really, only free charges contributed unless there was a stretching effect like the one that we were talking about today that is associated with bound charges, because bound charges ordinarily overlap and they cancel one another, okay? So we are going to, from now on, revise our definitions in a slightly different fashion and call the divergence of epsilon naught times E to be the rho, and we will associate that rho with the free charge densities. From now on, we say that nature is full of charges, but some are free, some are not free. Our rho is going to account for the free charge densities, and then we have a certain interpretation that is coming along. This is starting to look like Gauss's law, okay? This is starting to look like Gauss's law, and it is the divergence of what we were calling displacement is equal to free charge density minus something else. That should be the bound charge density. What we have, actually, divergence of displacement always equal to the total charge density, except that now we are recognizing that we have to make a distinction between free charge density and the bound charge density. And this is representing all the stretched outs, pluses and minuses, that we have sort of calculated in a macroscopic fashion. Any questions here? We are not very happy with what's going on here. We're going to make some changes. Since divergence is sitting here as well as here, why don't we take this guy and put it on top of this? And says now the divergence of epsilon naught times E plus the polarization is equal to the free charge density of rho. So that is the next step. Okay. So one step is recognizing that the total charge density is rho minus this divergence of the polarization, where our interpretation of negative divergence of polarization to be the bound charge density. And then transposing that term to the left-hand side, we have then divergence of this quantity is equal to rho. So now we're going to say, in vacuum, there was no material to polarize, therefore P was equal to zero, and we called epsilon naught times E to be D as a convenience, as a shorthand. But in material medium, we are going to have non-zero polarization, okay? Why don't we now agree to call this guy the displacement rather than just this guy, okay? So then we have an equation that reads just like our previous Gauss's law in differential form. Divergence of displacement is equal to rho. But the rho is only the free charge carriers from now on. So we are sort of like taking away and hiding the effect of bound charge carriers inside a new revised definition of D. We didn't have to do that in the first week of our class because we were not really thinking about bound charges. But now we have recognized there are bound charges and they have to be accounted for in Gauss's law. They can either sit in this fashion on the right-hand side and we have epsilon naught times E, or we can have this alternative option in which we lump their effect into D and deal with only the free charge carriers in the differential equations that we have, the differential form of Gauss's law. That's the gist of what really this whole thing is about. Any questions? So our revised definition of D is epsilon times E plus P, and that P is the number density of the polarizable material times the dipole moment that is associated with each atom, and that will be a charge times a distance, and we don't know how to calculate that yet, but we are going to make a sort of an operational assumption and procedure that will make things easy, okay? And ultimately, that equation with all these revisions become our good old equation, but our good old equation now being interpreted in a slightly different fashion. D is no longer a scale version of electric field. It is the scale version of electric field, epsilon naught times E plus the polarization. And what is sitting on the right-hand side is rho, that is free charge density. Any questions? Now, when we talk about the magnetic world and current densities and currents, a similar sort of a thing is going to come about. The motion of free charge carriers will generate a current density associated with them, but the jostling of the bound charges will also constitute a current, a bound current, and we will sort of decide to hide that current inside our revised definition of H. Okay? H so far, that we didn't really work so much about, but H so far is B divided by mu naught. But we will hide something else in it, the effect of the bound carrier currents. Okay, so that is going to be the next step. And when we are done, Maxwell's equations are going to have in them rho and j that we will only associate with free charge carriers. Okay? Only free charge carriers, the bounded charge carriers, charge and current effects have been hidden into D and E. This is what the engineers do. And this is what physicists don't do, actually. They try to stick with the free space version most of the time. Or physicists, when they want to do this sort of thing, they explicitly work with P. They don't lump together P and electric field the way we are doing here. Any questions? So ultimately, when we write down our engineering form of Maxwell's equations down the line, divergence of D is equal to rho. You know that this is the free charge density, and you know that this really means epsilon naught times E plus P, whatever that P is that I'm going to talk about a little bit more. Okay? Divergence of B is equal to zero. Curl of E is equal to minus dBdt. These two equations haven't changed, but then there is going to be a curl of H, J plus dBdt. Okay? This D and this D are the same. They contain inside the polarization, and this H contains something that comes about because of the existence of bound currents. All right? But the most important message here is rho here and j here is going to be in these forms of Maxwell's equations always associated with free charge carriers. Any questions? So I can then make the following step. From these sets of equations, we can go to boundary condition equations by doing the mnemonic that we went through last time. Okay, del becomes a unit vector n, and what survives are these guys. A rho sub s survives and J sub S survives. Now, evidently, since after all the work of hiding the bound charge effects inside D and H, these are left with the free carriers. The boundary condition equations, which are going to be N dot D difference is equal to rho sub S, has to be supported only with the surface charge density of free carriers. There is no surface charge density associated with the bound carriers. Okay? So therefore, when you are looking at the surface of a dielectric medium, that dielectric medium ideally has no free charge carriers in it. All the carriers are bound. That medium, that chunk of dielectric is not going to be able to provide for you, supply a natural surface charge density. You are only going to find the surface charge densities on the surfaces of conducting regions containing free charge carriers. And this is going to have relevance to the homework problems that you'll be doing that's due tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Any questions here? So what else can we say? This, in differential form, obviously implies the corresponding integral form equation. And in the integral form equation 2, from now on, we are going to look at this as the free charge density, the density of the free charge carriers, not the bound ones. Bound ones have been lumped into here. What else? This P that we need to add to epsilon E. That's a funny thing. We don't know. We don't have a complete model for this. Three lectures from now, we are going to have something more concrete. But for the time being, we're going to say the following. That P, that stretching, is dependent on the electric field, self-consistent electric field that you find within the medium. It is because of the presence of the electric field that the stretching takes place. That stretching generates the D. D times E times the number density atoms is P. That's what P is. Okay? So let us just simply agree that in many materials, perhaps, this P vector is going to be proportional to the E that is self-consistent. Okay? That makes sense. You say that I can, of course, test this. Okay, I can test this by going into the lab, apply electric fields, and look at the amount of polarization, and see whether the material is linear or not. You find that many materials that we work with are linear. Glass is linear, etc. You know, air is linear, unless you go to very large values of applied field and you make it spark, okay? So linearity is something that we sort of like exposed to in, let's say, EPC 210, and we have the intuition that many, many materials or systems are going to behave linearly when they are excited by small input. And at large inputs, these may all become sort of like distorted. A resistor may start behaving non-linearly, as you well know. So in that sense, in the sort of like the three-dimensional world of electromagnetics, many materials that we work with are linear. For those, we are going to say P is simply proportional to electric field, and we throw in some proportionality constants. Okay? And here's a proportionality constant that we call the susceptibility, electric susceptibility, and epsilon naught we place here. Why did we do it this way? Because things make sense then. If we substitute this here, that can be factored out in this way. Our new revised definition of D becomes good old epsilon naught, 1 plus something new, times the electric field. The additional part is the polarization, obviously, and we have sort of like decided effectively to sort of like label the strength of this polarization effect in terms of this electric susceptibility term. Any questions here? So then we are lazy. We write this whole thing is D is equal to epsilon E. So what used to be true in the past, D is equal to epsilon naught times E, has now migrated into D is equal to epsilon times the electric field. Epsilon has the same units of as epsilon naught, which is farads per meter. Okay? But you turn epsilon naught into epsilon by multiplying it with chi sub e, which is unitless. Okay? And the combination of this is how you turn it into epsilon. And this combination is what you call the epsilon sub r, relative permittivity. Okay? 2.25, for instance, for quarks. For various materials, you are going to have different relative permittivities, and that is going to then be sort of like symbolizing and representing this hiding effect of the bound charge carriers that are actually in the picture. Any questions? So here are some reasonable values. For air, epsilon sub r is very close to unity. So air behaves almost like vacuum, all right? That's why we don't distinguish between the speed of light in air versus vacuum. For glass, 4 to 10, quartz, also sort of related to glass, it's 2.25. That's something that we know very well. Dry to wet earth, 5 to 10. These are relative permittivities. Distilled water, 81, so forth. Most metals have epsilons. The epsilon sub r is very close to unity. They are characterized by their sigmas rather than epsilons. Okay. This is the picture that we want to work with. And then, what about the boundary condition equations? The boundary condition equation for the normal component of D, if you remember, is n dot d difference is equal to rho sub s. If we are at the dielectric surface, that rho sub s is going to be equal to zero, and therefore we are going to have the continuity of the normal component of D as we go from one dielectric to another dielectric. Unless this is an artificial problem where the professor or whoever is asking you the question has laid an artificial layer of charge. It is possible that you can take a dielectric and externally bring charge and spray it on that surface. It's going to hold there. You have to be told, okay? If you're not told that there is an extra layer of charge that is sitting on the surface of a dielectric, you assume that that surface charge density is equal to zero because it has to be brought in externally. So, in other words, our boundary condition equations simplify with these dielectrics. Zero jump in the normal component of the D field and also zero jump with the tangential component of the electric field. I think that's all I want to say from yesterday's lecture. So now, that takes us to today's lecture, and we are almost catching up. And this is just a sequence of examples. And here is the summary page, which pretty much says everything that I have said. Let's just jump directly into examples, because you have to solve example problems yourself as you're doing the homework. Okay, so in this example, what are we looking at? We are looking at a situation where we have a slab of dielectric that is surrounded by air. Air, dielectric, air. Okay, in the air, on both sides of this dielectric, you measure the same electric field. It is given as 18x in volts per meter, inside and outside. We are also given that the electric field inside the material to be 3x. So there is an electric field has changed. Electric field is not the same inside and outside. What is the mechanism for that? The mechanism for that is the polarization. That particular, the electric has polarized and it's canceling portion of the electric field that is otherwise in the system. Okay? And of course that the electric has some relative permittivity that we want to find. We don't know what that is. The question is about more or less that. Let's ask the question. Let's read the question. A perfect electric slab having a finite thickness W in X direction is surrounded by free space and a constant electric field 18x volts per meter in its exterior. Induced polarization of bound charges inside the dielectric reduces the electric field strength inside the slab from 18 to 3 volts per meter. What are the displacement and polarization vectors outside and inside the slab, and what is the dielectric constant? Okay. So how are we going to attack this problem? We're going to attack this problem by using the boundary condition. What was that boundary condition that I just summarized moments ago? Because these types of dielectric slabs cannot furnish surface charge densities, and there is no mention of a surface charge density that has been imposed externally or artificially, we have to assume that there is no jump in the D field from the exterior to the interior. Okay, so D is inside also the same D that we have for the outside. And for the outside, the D is epsilon naught times 18. You go from E to D in the outside by multiplying it with the permittivity of the free space, which is epsilon naught. In the exterior air, there is no polarization. We are treating air as vacuum. So D is equal to 18 epsilon naught. Okay, D is inside also 18 epsilon naught. Okay, that is only possible if the D that is appropriate for this region, which is epsilon R times epsilon naught, is equal to 6 times epsilon naught. All right. So we have different epsilons inside and outside. It is 6 times epsilon naught inside. Okay, that is going to generate from the 3 volts per meter electric field the same displacement that we find on the outside. Okay, so we are matching basically the normal component of displacement inside and outside, and that is dictating for us that the epsilon that is pertinent in the inside is going to be 6 epsilon naught. Okay, so then our epsilon sub r is equal to 6, and that is 1 plus chi e, and chi must be in this case 5. Susceptibility, electric susceptibility is this factor, unitless factor, and 1 plus that is giving us our dielectric constants or relative permittivity, which is in this case is equal to 6. We continue with the problem. Okay, what else were we asked? We were asked to find DEP. E's were given, E's were 18 and 3. These we already found, these are 18 epsilon naught in both cases, inside and outside. And what about P's? Well, if you know D's and E's, you should be able to get P's, because D and P are related in this fashion. D is equal to epsilon E plus P. So to get P, you just subtract from the given D, epsilon naught times electric field. All right? So within the material, the dielectric, our D is the same as the outside D, which is 18 epsilon naught. From that, we are subtracting electric field, which is 3x times epsilon naught. 18 minus 3 gives us 15. So we have a polarization that is 15. That is reducing the 18 all the way down to 3 as far as the electric field is concerned. Any questions here? And what is the polarization outside? We already answered that it is equal to 0. In vacuum, in air, there is no polarization. It's only these polarizable materials are going to have non-zero P's. And because of that non-zero P, there is going to be a difference between the displacement vector and simply epsilon naught times E. Any questions? All right, so that was one example. The next example is this. But before that, I want to say a few things about Poisson's equation. If you remember how we derived Poisson's equation, we stuck E equals minus the gradient of the voltage inside this equation of divergence of D. That was divergence of epsilon naught times E, and for E, we placed the minus the gradient of B. Now, in this new world, where we have lumped bound charge effects into our revised definition of D that is coming along with a revised definition of epsilon. We have epsilon replacing epsilon naught. Okay, the derivation would sort of like follow what we are seeing over there. Okay, we're going to replace this particular E with the minus the gradient of V. But then we can only pull this guy out and reach the same equation that we had before, if and only if this epsilon itself is not a function of position. Okay? In vacuum, there was only epsilon naught that mattered, and epsilon naught was a constant. It never changes with position. But in material media, epsilon can be changing as a function of position. It can be changing as a function of position in a continuous way in certain situations. In the atmosphere, for instance, where the atmospheric density is gradually changing, there will be a gradual change of that very little, your epsilon of 1.0006 will drop into 1.0004 by some altitude, and that's going to be happening gradually. Or you can have epsilon that is changing in given systems abruptly, because you have one slab next to another slab, etc. If epsilon is changing as a function of position, you cannot pull it out, because then there is a positional derivative. So the motto is, don't use Poisson's equation or Laplace's equation in situations where the material mediums epsilon is changing as a function of position. That's lesson number one. Lesson number two, in many practical problems, you're going to have, and such regions where epsilon is changing as a function of position, they are said to be inhomogeneous media. Homogeneous means it's all the same. Inhomogeneous means where you, as you move, you see different situations. So don't use Poisson's equations in inhomogeneous media problems. However, many practical inhomogeneous media problems are slab-wise. They are piecewise continuous. You have one chunk of material with the same epsilon here, followed by another chunk in which there is another one, but there is no variation within each chunk. So then you can use Poisson's equation in each of these chunks. And Poisson's equations have easy solutions in Cartesian geometries that we can take advantage of. And then what do? You solve each slab by the same technique of applying a linearly varying potential. That is what Laplace's equation is going to dictate for us. And then you match boundary conditions, that's all. This is again where the boundary condition issues become important. So the next homework the example problem is of that nature. Okay. Here is what we have. We have a layer here, and then air, and then some dielectric slab, and then some other layer. This may be a sort of the surfaces of conducting a capacitor, which is half air filled and half dielectric filled. You look at the problem more or less along those lines. Okay, we are given the charge density at the bottom surface, and we want to find out and we know the charge density also on the top surface. They are equal and opposite. And we are here to find out the electric field and the potential distribution in this problem. Okay, so how are we going to solve the problem? Well, we'll attack potential first. Each of these regions, the air and the electric slab, are going to have source free. Therefore, they have to satisfy the Laplace's equation. Okay, Poisson's equation as well as Laplace's equations can be applied in each of those slabs separately. And what is pertinent is the Laplace's equation, because the free charge density is equal to zero. And the solution of Laplace's equation in Cartesian geometries is easy. Second derivative equal to zero implies that the function itself should be only changing linearly. All right? And in this case, z is the variation direction. So at best, you have az plus b to be the solution that applies in each of those regions. Okay? We have two regions. And we are also said that to take the bottom potential to be zero. Remember that potential can always be arbitrarily set at some point to be zero, and then you worry about what the potential is at other locations. So we have a question mark there for the potential at V equal 2. V of 2 is unknown, but that is unknown that we are going to solve for by sort of like continuing the potential from zero in a linear fashion as we are seeing here. Okay? So basically then, in the region from the ground to z equal 1, that is crossing the region that is filled with air, I should start at 0 and just increase. And that will take me to a certain value at z equal 1. And the potential, there is always a unique potential that is associated at each location. The potential cannot jump there. So we're going to now continue the potential from there on, all the way to, sorry about this, I have a meeting coming up. So the potential will probably continue with a different slope and reach whatever value it has. So we have to find these two slopes. Effectively, that's what we have to do. So how do we attack this? Well, we know the charge density on the bottom ground. Okay, that charge density is going to then match to the electric field right above it. Why is that the case? A pair of, now let's read the example so that you will have the answer for that right away. A pair of infinite conducting plates at z equals 0 and z equals 2 meters carry equal and opposite surface charge densities. So we have the yellow is the red surface there is the surface of a perfect conductor or a good conducting material, let us say, at a DC situation. Therefore, the electric field inside is equal to, say it. Zero. Zero electric field inside, okay, and we are given the surface charge density. So what is then the electric field right about the surface? Well, let's think in terms of D, it's better. D should match the surface charge density. So D for that region is going to be, which is electric field for that region times epsilon naught, because epsilon naught is the permittivity of that region, is equal to the given charge density. Here I write that. Epsilon naught times A is given the is the charge density. Okay? And I have some signs there. Why am I taking them to be like this? Okay, so let's do step by step. If the potential here is A times Z, okay, then the electric field is going to be the negative the gradient of that. I am just following that logic there. Okay, and that is going to give me, because of the negative sign, ddc of AC times the unit vector C is going to be, this is going to be the electric field. Okay? So that electric field dotted into that times the epsilon naught is going to be the D field. I am expressing the D field in terms of A, which is showing up in my potential solution. That A is my slope, so that I said we need to get the slope, so I'm doing it in that fashion. Okay? So this is our electric field, and that times epsilon naught is minus A epsilon naught Z hat. I multiply that with the unit vector that is in the normal direction, okay, and that is Z hat. Z hat dotted into Z hat gives me plus 1. So therefore, this evaluates to minus epsilon naught times A. And that is equal to the surface charge density. And that surface charge density was given as minus 2 epsilon naught. So therefore, A is equal to 2. Okay? So a little bit confusing there if you are not paying attention to the signs, but everything is consistent there. Okay? So overall, we know that if there is minus charges here and plus charges there, as given by the given surface charge density, that the electric field should be pointing from the top to the bottom. Okay, that's we know. And we also know that if that is the case, the potential should be high on the top and low on the bottom. And my graph is reflecting that. So everything is therefore turning out to be consistent. We have an electric field in the air region that is pointing in minus Z direction, in the overall direction of plus to minus charges. And that is giving me a D field that is also pointing in the opposite direction to the unit vector direction. And that's why I have a negative sign here, and I get my A to be 2. All right, so then what about the solution in the next region? We have written that solution in terms of the same A, and then some B. You guys cannot see that portion. Can you see it now? Yes. Okay. I have selected to represent my potential in this fashion because if I evaluate this at z equal to 1, this term disappears and I get my A. All right? And then about that, this term gives me the sort of the variation, the linear variation that I need, and B is the slope. So I need to get also the B. And this is where I am going to take advantage of the fact that the D should be the same at the boundary when I go to this location, I should have exactly the same D expressions, because there is no surface charge. Okay, the continuity of the normal component of D can be applied at that location. Okay, and we can express D for the second medium in terms of the electric field of the first one. That is the gradient of this. Okay, we'll take the gradient of this, and that is going to generate an electric field. Then we'll take that electric field and multiply it with the epsilon that belongs to this medium, and that is no longer epsilon naught, but it is twice epsilon naught, and that is going to give me an expression for D component there. I'm going to set that D component equal to the D component I have from below, and that is going to give me my B. Okay. And that is exactly what we are going through there. Just below Z equal 1, the displacement is minus 2 epsilon naught Z, as we have established before. Above Z equals 1, the electric field is the gradient, minus gradient of A plus B, Z minus 1, which is minus BZ. Okay? Therefore, D plus, that is the D that I measured just above Z equals 1 surface, is going to be that quantity minus B hat times the epsilon that is pertinent for that medium, which is twice epsilon naught. So I multiply this with twice epsilon naught to get this. Okay? So that D component in Z direction should match the D that we have coming from below. We equate them, and so for B. B is equal to 1. So then, with A 2 and B equal 1, we return to our voltage equation and place them in here. Okay? We have different slopes, and the problem, therefore, is indeed sort of like consistent with the original picture that we guessed for the potential. Any questions here? Now that we have the potential all the way in both regions, we can evaluate the potential at Z equals 2. 2 minus 1 gives me 1, 1 plus 2, 3. 3 is the potential that we have on the top. And the electric fields can also be written in numerical values. Any questions here? Yes?
So the reason we can, I guess it's what the boundary condition is, because it's a dielectric?
Yes, exactly, that's what I'm doing there. And I am making the assumption that that surface doesn't have any charge density. I have not been told in the problem there is a charge density. Therefore, I assume there is not.
Okay? What's the charge density?
If there was a metallic surface, a metallic surface always produces a charge density on its surface if there is a non-zero field outside the metal, because inside the metal there has to be zero field. Okay? Basically, the charge carriers that are free to move around are pulled to furnish that surface charge density. With metal transitions, when we go from air to metal, we are going to expect to have surface charge density. In fact, if the air has electric field, the inside has zero electric field, there is going to be always a surface charge density. With the dielectrics, there is no pre-charge carriers to furnish a surface density. Therefore, you say the surface charge density is equal to zero. The only exception for this is that somebody has externally brought some charge and spread it out. That is a possibility, but then you would be told about that. Okay, so now, I think we have run out of time, but this is a very important and weird problem, okay? Challenging problem. Look at this problem. I will discuss this problem at the beginning of next lecture, which is tomorrow. And you guys are now in a situation to finish all the homework problems, okay? But we'll have some more examples tomorrow that may help with it. But start finishing the last three homework problems. I think it's 7, 8, and 9. And attack them. Yes?
We have more Tuesday.
Pardon?
We have more Tuesday.
Yes, we will have. Exam is on Wednesday.
Is that
yes. Yeah, I'm going to post that Tuesday homework problem today.
That we have the exam.
One page. One page. We have a homework that we are finishing now, right? And then there's going to be a homework that I'm going to collect on Tuesday. That is going to be included.
So from that, yeah. Two homework on back. Yeah. What we should focus on for the day.
Right, exactly. Yes.
Previous lectures, by name.